The Guardian.
The Guardian has partnered with audible.co.uk to offer listeners a free audiobook when you sign up for a one-month, no-commitment trial of the Audible service. Audible has over 50,000 audiobook titles available to download. Go to guardian.co.uk/audible for further details.
Hello, this is Science Weekly. I'm Alok Jha. On the show this week...
And 007 has been poisoned with this on a couple of occasions. He emerges from these things shaken but not stirred.
From James Bond to the Frankenstein monster, Professor Francis Ashcroft is here to discuss why electricity is so important in the human body. And...
The songs that sound good to them are the songs that get to have sex and reproduce. The ones they don't like, they just die.
You've heard of evolution through natural selection in biology, but what about music? Professor Armand Leroy, one of the scientists behind a project called Darwin Tunes, will be here to explain how he's used evolutionary ideas to create a perfect pop tune. And what does open science mean to you? If it means nothing at all, then you're in luck. Professor Geoffrey Boulton, author of a report on this very subject for the Royal Society, will explain how modern technologies and huge data sets will mean that scientists will need to start thinking very carefully about how they do their science in future. This is Science Weekly from The Guardian. Frances Ashcroft is a physiologist at Oxford University. In the early 1980s, she found the link between increased sugar levels in the blood and the production of the hormone insulin. Her work informed our understanding of diabetes and eventually led to the development of a treatment for a rare neonatal form of the condition. Frances was named a laureate of the 2012 L'Oréal UNESCO Women in Science Awards, and she's also written a book on the role of electricity in the body called Spark of Life. When I met Frances, I started by asking her to tell me about a crucial part of every cell in our bodies, the ion channel.
Well, ion channels are really nothing more than little gated pores that sit in the membrane of every one of your cells and of every organism on Earth, whether it's a giant redwood in California or a simple bacterium. And they govern everything we do. So your ability to hear and see me, to think and feel, to move your arms and legs is all down to the electrical activity that's taking place in the nerve cells in your brain and the muscle cells in your limbs. And that in turn is down to the opening and closing of these little ion channels. I think very few people have heard of them, but they're vitally important for every part of our lives. So ion channels, for example, are what determines whether you win the great sperm race or not, because there are ion channels in sperm which are activated when the sperm gets near the egg and provide the extra thrust to the sperm so that it can penetrate the egg. So if they don't open, then the man is sterile and the sperm can't fertilise the egg.
So from the moment of conception to every process that...
Till the last breath you breathe, because in fact we define death as when the electrical activity of our brain ceases.
So when the ion channels stop.
When the ion channels run down.
Now, it's worth saying an ion, I-O-N, is actually just a charged particle. So it's a charged molecule or a charged atom in chemistry. So these are the things that that make cells behave or act in certain ways. Now, you've given some examples of the kinds of things that ion channels might be responsible for. But can you go into some specifics? What kinds of things are... You talked about sperm, for example. What else do they do?
Ion channels do just about everything you can think of. They're important for the impulses that travel along your nerves, carrying information from one end to another. They play a key role in muscle contraction. They're particularly important in the heart because they're responsible for its electrical activity. And when the electrical activity of the heart goes wrong, then the heart will stop. In fact, there are ion channel diseases known where there are mutations in ion channels in the heart, and they can result in sudden cardiac death. Ion channels are very important in regulating the electrical activity of the heart. So the ability of the heart to beat is all down to ion channels. Other things that they do are regulate the fluxes of ions across the kidney. So they're important in regulating the salt balance of your body and therefore in whether you have hypertension or hypotension. If you don't have enough salt excreted, then you might get too high blood pressure, and that can also result from defective ion channels. One of the most common diseases that many people will have heard of is cystic fibrosis, which is caused by mutations in an ion channel that's found in the lung. And unfortunately, there's no known cure for that disease yet.
No, so ion channels essentially are the regulators of electricity throughout the body in very subtle ways. It's a familiar concept, I think, to most people, that electricity is involved in doing things around the body. Maybe not in terms of big conducting wires or something going from different places that some people might think, but these are very subtle electrical currents around cells that make them nudge them in different ways. Take us back through the history of this a little bit. When did people start thinking that electricity in its grossest form was something that was in the body?
I think the father of animal electricity was Luigi Galvani, a great Italian scientist, who was the first to show that when an electrical spark is generated, it can actually cause a frog's leg to twitch. And he discovered this one day serendipitously when he was doing an experiment, and he noticed that when a spark was generated by his electrical machine, so this would have been a bit of static electricity, and his assistant was touching the nerve that supplied the frog's leg, the frog's legs twitched. So the next thing that he did was he wondered whether, in fact, lightning could do the same thing. So he wired his frog's leg up to the nerve that supplies the frog's leg up to a wire and connected it to a spike pointing into the sky.
I'm slightly worried where this is going.
And he found that when the electrical storm came across, the frog's legs twitched. And from further control experiments, he discovered that the frog's legs could actually also twitch even when there was no lightning around. So he hypothesized that that was because animals have their own endogenous form of electricity. And he was right, but his colleague, Alessandro Volta, contested his idea and went on to show that, in fact, electricity can also be generated by dissimilar muscles side by side. And, in fact, under some circumstances, that's what had been causing the frog's legs to twitch. And he went on to invent the first electric battery. But people still were very interested in Galvani's experiments, and the most extraordinary instances of this was his nephew, Aldini, who carried out experiments on recently decapitated criminals. And he applied electrical currents to the nerves that supplied their legs and arms and discovered that they twitched wildly and causing great consternation in the people in his audience. And I suspect that some of these rather extraordinary demonstrations were what generated the idea of Frankenstein in Mary Shelley's novel, which was written afterwards.
It sounds exactly like that, and this idea of using electricity to bring life to dead things.
It's very interesting, actually, because Mary Shelley didn't actually say that Frankenstein's monster was animated with lightning. We all believe that because of a film which was made about it, which starred Boris Karloff. In fact, all she said was the instruments of life.
It's very interesting. And can I, these experiments that were done with the decapitated criminals' heads, you've got to wonder where the ethics committees were back then, or maybe there weren't any. But obviously very important results nonetheless. So how did that develop into this description of the ion channel then? Because going from twitching frogs' legs and criminals' bodies and lightning to the molecular understanding that we've discussed earlier. I mean, that's a big leap.
It took a long time and it's very complicated and it required lots of special instruments. So it went hand in hand, really, with the development of electrical recording and measurement apparatus. And the first thing that they solved, really, was the mystery of how nerves produce electrical impulses. And they went on from that to show that the impulses are produced by the opening and closing of ion channels. But it's actually quite difficult to explain. And when I was a student at university, it took me at least 3 years to understand exactly how the electrical impulse in a nerve was generated. And I have to confess that I found it so difficult that it was one of the things I had to work hardest at. And then, of course, I got captivated and I ended up studying it.
Yeah, well,
but if I explain it from the basis of the ion channel rather than the historical way, it's much easier to understand. No, in fact, it's clear.
I was going to say, you've got 2 minutes rather than 3 years. Do it in terms of the ion channel. Because, I mean, how is the electricity generated then?
It's really very simple. When the ion channel opens, ions such as sodium or potassium will flow through. And they'll flow from an area of high concentration to an area of low concentration. And so, because the inside of our cells is low in sodium, when the sodium channels open, sodium ions will move from outside the cell to inside it. And because they are charged particles, they carry an electric current. And that electric current can be measured, and that's what was measured to demonstrate that ion channels actually exist. And the other thing to think about is that because you're moving charged particles from one compartment to another compartment, you'll get a lot more positive charge inside the cell. And that's essentially all that the nerve impulse is. What happens is ions move inside, they make the inside of the cell positive, and then potassium channels open and potassium ions move in the opposite direction and restore the electrical balance. So what you see is a wave of positive potential moving along the nerve, and that's what the action potential or nerve impulse
and it's just
is.
These sodium and potassium and calcium ions moving in and out of cells.
Yeah, it's just the sodium channels opening and sodium ions moving in, and then the potassium channels opening and potassium ions moving out.
So it sounds simple when you say it like that.
It's really simple. But what it does is it's the thing that's enabling you to talk to me.
And of course, as you said right at the beginning, it enables you to see things, touch things, feel things, smell things. Everything essentially is every sensation along a nerve fiber and many other things besides is down to these currents moving along. So when you hear something, it's because electrical currents are moving from your ear to your brain.
Each one of our senses is also regulated by ion channels. So what the ion channels do is they convert the information that comes in the form of light energy into electrical energy in the form of nerve impulses. It's exactly the same when you listen to me. The sound waves are converted into electrical impulses in your nerves. The other thing you should also remember is that it's actually the physical basis of our personality, of the people we actually are. Because when you don't have electrical impulses in your brain anymore, you're dead. So your whole consciousness is down to the electrical activity of
memories,
the brain.
All those things.
Your memories, for example, are down to electrical impulses in your nerves, and that in turn is down to the ion channels that are involved. And one particular type of these are known as glutamate receptors. So glutamate is a chemical messenger that enables nerve cells to talk to one another. And the way that it does this is by being released by one nerve cell and then diffusing across, moving across to the next nerve cell, where it binds to receptors and opens an ion channel, which then triggers an electrical impulse in the next cell. And what happens in memory is that actually structural changes occur that strengthen these connections between nerve cells. And that in turn is due to the operation of ion channels.
So you mentioned some of the reasons, some of the diseases that can happen if ion channels go wrong. The genetic mutation you mentioned right at the beginning that causes the rare form of diabetes, the cystic fibrosis. What else can go wrong if your ion channels are somehow compromised?
I think one of the most extraordinary things is that many drugs and many toxins act on ion channels. So the very famous toxin is known as tetrodotoxin, which is found in the fugu, the puffer fish of Japan. And if you eat that, it blocks your sodium channels, blocks your nerve impulses, and eventually you cease breathing and die. And 007 has been poisoned with this on a couple of occasions. As you may remember, I think he was kicked by one of the Smurf agents with a poison-filled spike on her boot. And he was only kept alive because his colleague provided artificial respiration. And I think he met it on more than one occasion. But of course, as ever,
he's emerges. He's slightly superhuman, though. So.
He emerges from these things shaken but not stirred.
Yeah, very good. What else can go wrong?
So many, many other toxins can work this way. Some of them don't act by blocking ion channels. They act by opening them and stimulating them too much. And one of those, which I find particularly fascinating, is called mad honey syndrome. It's a toxin known as gryanotoxin that's made by rhododendrons. The bees collect the nectar that's full of this toxin and they put it in their honey. And then when you eat it, you become intoxicated. And Xenophon was the first, was one of the first to describe this. And he found that his troops were hors de combat, lying about, miserable, groaning, in a state of great dejection. And he described this, and 200 years later, some of the, I think they were the Greeks, decided that this might make a very effective biological warfare agent. And they strewed it over the ground, and a couple of cohorts of Roman troops were then incapacitated, during which time they were then decapitated. So I think it's a very interesting toxin.
They weren't thinking about ion channels, I'm
very
sure.
Improbably, yeah. It's used today. In the Black Sea area around Trabzon in Turkey, it's thought to be good against impotence.
But does it work?
It doesn't work, and unfortunately people end up in hospital as a consequence.
Oh, gosh.
I should also say, of course, that many therapeutic drugs work by interacting with ion channels. So every time you go to the dentist and you have an injection, what you're actually getting is you're getting a drug that is blocking the sodium channels in your nerves. That's why you don't feel anything, because there are no longer any nerve impulses.
And so it can be a good thing too.
They're very, very important therapeutic agents. And drugs that work on ion channels are incredibly important therapeutic agents. This is how, for example, most anaesthetics work, many, many other drugs, and they bring in a great deal of money for the pharmaceutical industry.
Probably a good place to leave it. Francis, thank you very much. The Spark of Life, Electricity in the Human Body, is published by Alan Lane and available in book or electronic form from June the 28th. Natural selection is the key idea in Charles Darwin's masterwork of evolution. Most of us understand what it is and are probably very much caught up in it. But it's one thing to think of natural selection in terms of tail feathers and high cheekbones. It's another to apply the concept to music. That's exactly what a team of evolutionary biologists at Imperial College London are doing, though, with their Darwin Tunes project. What we're listening to now is a highly evolved piece of electropop. This is the progeny of the Darwin Tunes project. But let's pause the music for a second and get Armand Leroy, one of the evolutionary biologists behind the project, to tell us a bit more. Welcome back to the podcast, Armand. Now, you don't often get biology professors making music, so is this the start of a new career for you?
I don't know if it's the start of a new career, but it's certainly the start of a new direction in my research. The reason for that is because it's quite similar to what I was doing in the past. This is about the evolution of music.
We will listen to some of these tunes a bit later. But for a bit of background, just explain natural selection. Just explain Darwin's ideas to people in a couple of sentences so that then when we talk about the music later and what you did with it, we can sort of hang some of the ideas off it.
The idea of natural selection is very simple. So Darwin asked the question. It's the question we still ask. Why are there so many different things in the world? And I mean natural things. All those different and beautiful and glorious animals and plants and all their fabulous diversity. The answer he gave is that there's only one creative force capable of giving that, and that's natural selection. And that's the idea that there is variation, which is produced by various kinds of genetic processes, like mutation, for example, but that not all variants are equal. Some of them are more equal than others, and so some of them survive and reproduce, and those are the ones which then go on to fill the world. Simple as that.
And you've tried to apply this to music.
Absolutely.
Give us a sense of what Darwin Tunes is.
Darwin Tunes is a Darwinian music engine. That's all it is. And it works very much in the way that natural selection works on wild populations of animals. So we have a computer which generates these songs. They're not really songs, actually. They're just little 8-second loops of noise. And they're just random bits of noise. And they sound pretty terrible. We'll hear some in a few minutes. So these loops, they get together and they exchange genetic material. They have sex, in effect. And these loops then have baby loops. So it's songs having baby songs. So we've got a population of them, and then we've got the next generation, we've got another population of them. And if that's all there was, then nothing would happen, because bad songs, horrible songs would make horrible songs forever and forever and forever. But we add an extra ingredient, and that ingredient is selection. We take our songs, we stream them out onto the web, and we ask people to rate them. And here's the trick, is that we own only the songs which people like. The songs that sound good to them are the songs that get to have sex and reproduce. The ones they don't like, they just die. Do that for a couple thousand generations, and you've got music out of noise.
So in the analogy then, these 8-second loops have some sort of genetic information. I use genetic in inverted commas, musical information, which they're sharing with other loops to produce the baby loops. Are there mutations as well?
Absolutely. So when we, in our paper, which we wrote in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, we talk about the genome of the songs. We use biological metaphors absolutely straightforwardly. But what we're talking about, of course, is information, but it's the information actually in the little bit of computer code that makes the songs. So when two songs get together, they mix up their code. That's recombination. That's pretty much like what happens when we have sex or any other animal has sex. And then we also allow them to mutate, just to throw in a total wild card, as it were. And every generation, you're getting a whole new spectrum of musical variants out there. And that's the stuff, the raw material for evolution.
And of course, in a normal environment, you've got plants and animals evolving, but and making their babies and having mutations. Then the selection pressure comes from the environment around them, whether there's enough food, whether there's competition and all of these things. And in your scenario, it's the people rating the songs. That's the environment that allows things to survive or not.
That's exactly right. You know, the thing is this. When we look at the natural world and we ask, what is the creative force that gave it? There's only one, it's natural selection. But when we look at the cultural world, which is also so wonderfully diverse, all the songs that we listen to, we say, where does all that stuff come from? We never say it's selection. We tend to say, oh, genius has made it. We tend to say that genius has made it. It's the product of stuff that producers make and musicians, you know. Lennon and McCartney handed the torch to the Gallagher brothers, handed the torch to, you know, Chris Martin, you know, Bach to Beethoven to Bartok. I mean, that's how we tend to think about the origin of music. But we forget that we're actually imposing a selective force upon music as well, a massive one. And that's what we do when we choose one piece of music over another. And in effect, this experiment allows us to ask, what happens if you take the composer out of the equation and just have choice? Can you get music?
Shall we listen to some of the results?
Yeah, let's.
So we've got a few. Let's start with the random loops that have no evolution, no evolutionary pressure on them at all. These are the things that you just produced right at the beginning. That doesn't sound terrible to me at all. That just sounds a bit like Tubular Bells or something, a bit of a soundtrack or something. Anyway, but that's just random noise.
Yeah, well, we did choose the best of the bunch there, right? I mean, you know, some of the tracks, they're just silent. You know, there's just a lethal mutation. Some of them, you know, are just vague little whispering noises. I mean, and some of them are just unreasonably harsh upon the ear. But that's what you get if you just allow things to just have random noise, right?
So let's go through some generations then.
Okay, so the next one track is from the generation 400, is from generation 400. So the population has been going for 400 generations, selection has been imposed for 400 generations. At this point, things are beginning to sound pretty good.
See, now that does sound better. It sounds that you're getting to the soundtrack of a romantic comedy there. There's something quite bright and happy about that song.
That's right. It's bright, it's happy. If you study the actual properties of the music, which we did using various algorithms, you can show that we've got chords at this point where we didn't have previously. So we've got actually harmonics in there. We've got pretty sophisticated rhythms. And we're even getting little melodies. So again,
and these things are not because someone's written these melodies or anything like that.
There's no composer in there. Yeah. This is just the result.
Well, I'm quite
of
interested
choice.
To hear the next one then, given that.
All right, so we go through to about 2,500 generations in this experiment, and here's a little selection of what we heard.
So that was 2,500 generations. And I'm not just saying this, you hear rhythm there. There's breaks, there's melody, there's chords. It does sound like a real piece of music.
It does. And we're even getting, and this is to me quite amazing, if you listen closely, you can actually hear particular instruments. You know, like we get a snare drum in one of our pieces at 2,500 generations. And here's the thing. We didn't program in a snare drum anywhere. We could have. We could have started with a whole bunch of synthesized instrument sounds with their appropriate harmonics. But we didn't. It's rather as though the snare drum has been assembled just by natural selection. That's what people felt was needed there. So they chose it there. And they put it there, as it were. Along with the blind, because the variation was there to do it. I mean, it's quite amazing, actually.
So just in terms of the, if you deconstruct this a little bit, what's actually going on? You've created these loops right at the beginning, and you have the program information. But what is it that's actually, what are the genes? What are the bits of base pairs and DNA? What's actually moving around?
So every song is constructed from a little bit of computer code. And that code, which you can represent in sort of a tree-like way, which is just the way you can represent these kind of genomes. Each branch will have a particular instruction to make a particular kind of sound, a note, which will then be prolonged for a certain period of time, and then stop, and then reiterate, and so on. And so you can have many different layers of these branches. The little tree of the code can become very bushy and very, very complicated, depending on how complex it becomes. And indeed, as we proceed, we find that the code is becoming much, much more complicated. More branches are being added to it. The genome is getting bigger. And as it does so, the songs become more complex. Something like that.
Bring this back into the real world. Does it have any explanations for, you know, the popularity of particular types of song or types of music? Or are you too far away from something, explanations like that?
Well, the first question you could ask is, why is it that, turn it around and just ask, why is it that we evolved little electronic-y kinds of sounds? And I have to say, in part, that's partly the limitations of the system, probably, because we're beginning with computer-generated sound, but it's also probably the people who are actually choosing this stuff. I mean, we had undergraduates, right, at Imperial College, and we had sort of the techie, webby, savvy people out there, the sort of slightly geeky people who actually come onto websites.
Computer gamers, maybe.
Exactly. The sort of people who come to websites and sort of, you know, prepare to spend hours choosing bits of really rubbish music in order to hope of getting something good at the end. So no surprise that we get kind of electronica, you know, chill out music out the other end in a way, right? Be very interesting to know what would happen if we got a completely different set of people to do the same
Death
experiment.
Metal fans, for example.
For example, or, you know, I don't know, we go to China and we get, you know, a lot of Chinese people, because I suppose just looking at, you know, at looking where the people came from, we don't know who they are, but, you know, they're all pretty much Brits and some Europeans and some North Americans, basically. So in terms of actually understanding what this tells us about the world out there, the real world of music, I think it's got a few interesting lessons. One of them is that we found that although we could evolve music, we couldn't evolve it. The system didn't keep on going indefinitely. It plateaued out. And that's very interesting. We think that may actually tell us something about the conservatism of music in certain kinds of cultures, especially traditional cultures, where music stays the same for a very, very long time. We think that when songs become sufficiently complex, that they can't, to some degree, get any better because mutation and recombination just keeps on wearing them down. And when you have cultures in which you have no symbolic or mechanical means of transmission, then we think that process is happening too. That's a little bit abstract, but we do think that the system is telling us something about the dynamics of music in culture out there.
Now, what does this tell you about, also about digital music, given that nowadays we have access to lots and lots of things? I mean, you mentioned how different cultures might have different expressions of this stuff, but now we can get anything you want and you can download it and mix it up yourself and do whatever you like with it. Lots of composers around. Does it, in the past you've had producers and composers and things who sort of guide things along, but are their roles going to disappear?
This, I think, is the fascinating question. Darwin Tunes proves that you can make music without a composer, and it suggests that the creative force exerted by choice, consumer choice, could be powerful. But of course, people will protest. But people, composers, actually do make music, right? We know that's true. And that is true. And yet, when we look at a world in the new world of digital music in which everybody is downloading stuff and messing around with it and uploading it and so on, I think that we are shifting to a world in which Darwin Tunes is very much more an accurate model of how music is going to evolve. That is to say, in which millions of people are just going to sort of mess around and generate stuff, and most of it's going to be complete rubbish because most of them won't know what they're actually doing. But you're going to upload it, and people are going to pick it up, and the good stuff is going to spread.
And the selection pressure in that case is when someone else downloads it and does something else with it.
Exactly. So I think, you know, the democratization of music making looks much more like a Darwin Tunes world. Just as Darwin Tunes, I think, also looks more like a world in a pre-industrial world before the world of high art music and the cult of the composer, which is what we've had in the modern era.
Now you're a cultured man. You like composers like the rest of us. Is that a brave world that we're entering, or do you think that it's a shame that composers perhaps won't have as much influence and power?
No, it's a very interesting question. Oh, I think the world will continue. I think all that stuff will generate, be out there. And then I think it's just a matter of personal choice as to what you listen to. And my suspicion is, actually, that I'm not going to be listening a whole lot to Darwin Tunes type music, frankly.
Armand, thank you so much.
It's my pleasure, Alan.
Thanks to Armand Lirouard there. For more information on his project, visit the website darwintunes.org. If you talk to anyone about openness of science these days, you might get back something about open access to scientific research papers. Or perhaps open source science experiments and the role of the citizen scientist, something we discussed in last week's special programme. But many scientists are thinking about openness in a slightly different way. As the scientific endeavour gets more complicated, more collaborative, and produces reams of data, the practice of scientific research has started to change. The internet has usurped printed journals as the best way for scientists and non-scientists to communicate and share ideas. The same technologies allow for greater transparency and, increasingly, the credibility of big research groups can rest on the public release of data and evidence that underlie their scientific ideas. The Royal Society convened a working group to try and address some of these questions. Last week, that group produced a report, Science as a Public Enterprise, Opening Up Scientific Information. The working group was chaired by Professor Geoffrey Boulton from the School of Geosciences at the University of Edinburgh. He came into the studio to tell me more about the role of openness in 21st century science. Geoffrey, welcome to the podcast. Give us a bit of background to the report, Science as an Open Enterprise. Why did the Royal Society put together a panel for this issue?
Well, it all started about 3-4 years ago. You remember the so-called Climategate affair, where it seemed that scientists had been highly reticent in being open about the data which supported conclusions which are really enormously important for human society and the lives of most of us. And the Royal Society decided that it was really very important that it should address this issue. And as we began to do so, we began to realize actually there was a prior problem, and it was about maintaining openness in science. Because since the 17th century, the last 300 years, then openness has been the prerequisite for science, which is the means whereby scientific progress has been made. In other words, you make a suggestion, produce an argument about something which you believe to be true, but at the same time, you publish the data on which it's based. And the large question for us now is whether the enormous volumes of data that we're able to acquire, to store, to manipulate, change the way in which we maintain that openness. And the reason the openness has been so important is that it permits others to question your logic, view your data, to agree or disagree with the theory you've created, to reuse your data to carry the argument forward. And what it's meant is that science has been a self-correcting process, which has actually been the basis by which it's become a reliable form of knowledge. And our big question was, given the massive data volumes that sweep over us now, given the changes that citizens believe is appropriate in themselves seeking the evidence which underlies scientific conclusions, then are we still doing things right, or do things have to change?
So we're talking about subjects like climate change, where there's millions of data points in these models, the Human Genome Project as well, of course, which is ever-growing as a database of genetic information and knowledge. The Large Hadron Collider, a favourite on this podcast. Lots of data coming out about potential Higgs bosons and other things. These are huge data sets. What is the way of publishing them? If they're not, there's no point publishing them in, you know, in paper form. It doesn't seem sensible. So how do you make them accessible and meaningful? Because data by itself is just numbers, right?
Well, there are quite a lot of scientific communities that have tackled these issues and are now utilising vast data volumes in a way that we would think are quite appropriate. They're the, if you like, pathfinders and new ways of doing science. So, for example, the Bermuda Protocols that were signed 20 years ago now about the immediate release of data relating to the human genome. That data now is routinely released even before people have published the papers on it. What is meant is that the scientific community in that domain are able to explore and exploit and discover things from an enormous data set and not just the data which their own laboratory has produced. And effectively what they've discovered, this is a much more powerful and creative and efficient way of doing science than they did before. And increasingly many other disciplines are following. And what we're trying to do is to persuade, if you like, the whole of the scientific enterprise to open their eyes to this new collaborative data sharing way of doing science.
So let's go through some examples of how being more open in the way you've described and making this data robust can help in not only science, but also in for societal benefits. To take us through some examples in the report, you talk about, for example, the release of the NASA's Landsat data. This is quite interesting.
Yes. Well, until about a dozen years ago, the US Geological Survey, which was the repository of NASA Landsat data, used to sell that data internationally. And about 10, 12 years ago, they concluded that they wouldn't do that, but they'd actually make it freely available to those who applied for it. And the consequence of that was that before they'd sold about 140 data sets a year, they now have something like 700,000 downloads. And when I asked the people at the USGS about whether this was beneficial to the US, they said, we're not quite sure what the overall economic impact is, but it's immensely increased our influence internationally, and it's created for us enormous numbers of collaborations that weren't there hitherto. And they have no doubt whatsoever that it's been greatly beneficial, not only to the US science community in this area, but also in those who exploit the data.
I mean, Google Maps used this information.
Absolutely.
And you say in the report that it has potentially almost $1 billion worth of economic activity around it because this stuff's become available. So creative minds thinking of ways to use and explore it. We've talked about the benefits of releasing data to the public, to the quality of science. There's also another aspect. When Sir Paul Nurse spoke to us on this podcast a while ago about the climate gate situation, he noted that one of the things that is happening to many scientists now is extreme numbers of FOI, freedom of information requests, for data from people who are perhaps being malicious in their intent and curtailing these people's research. Is the idea to, why don't we just publish all the data in a robust way, a way of curtailing some of those sorts of problems, this sort of idea that, you know, a researcher could be hounded for this information?
Well, I think that if you, in a sense, if a member of the public is seriously interested in the evidence behind a scientific concept, then I see no reason at all why that data shouldn't be made available. So we take the view that openness of itself is of no value, unless it is what we call intelligent openness. For example, the response to many FOI requests is to dump enormous amounts of data and information on the desk of the person who's asked for it, and they very often can make neither head nor tail of it. And for us, intelligent openness is, first of all, you should be able to find the data. It's accessible. You should be able to understand it. It's intelligible. You should be able to assess it. And who produced it? How competent are they? Do they have a financial interest in a particular outcome? And fourthly, you should be able to use it. Now, the problem there is that if you say, well, all science ought to be open in an intelligent way, you'd stop doing science tomorrow, because the work you need to do in order to make something intelligently open is enormous. And so our view is that what we should do is look at those areas where there is already an expressed public concern and interest, which are very often areas of health, climate change, you've already mentioned, and so on, and say which are the things where we should make a special effort to make data intelligently open so that informed citizens can make their own decisions about issues which are of public concern.
So it's unlikely that the Large Hadron Collider is going to have to make its data available so easily. I'm sure they'd do it if you asked them, though.
maybe they would.
What are the best ways of utilising the data, the vast amounts of data that we're getting these days?
Well, one of the problems that we have is that we tend to ask questions of data in ways that were appropriate to earlier modes of scientific inquiry, where the amount of data available was very small. What we still tend to do, and it's a sin that I commit, I know, is to have a preconception of the structures and the relationships that lie in the data. And so we search for those relationships, and we usually find them. What we don't do is ask the question, what patterns are intrinsic to this important data set, and what discoveries can I make about relationships in it? In other words, things are unexpected relationships that are delivered to you. Last night, for example, we had a meeting involving Paul Nurse, who mentioned that he'd taken some medicines for a heart problem he's had recently. And one of the things he noticed was his tinnitus, which he's had for 20 years, disappeared. And it was a side effect. And actually, of course, if we had complete information about all the consequences of taking particular medicines, then we'd have a much better idea of the relationship between cause and effect. Now, if you look at the way in which modern clinical trials are run, when they're reported, what tends to happen is that only positive results are reported. You lose the negative results, and the consequence of that is that the relationship between cause and effect is obscured. And in our view, and this, in a sense, repeats an axiom that Albert Einstein used, which was you should use all the data. Actually, you should use all the data. You mustn't cherry pick. Cherry picking, either conceptually or in practice, actually ought to be regarded as scientific malpractice. And we're going to push that very strongly indeed, that if we're going to exploit the real potential this new world of data offers us, then we're going to have to think about how to use it in quite different ways than we have in the past. Not even starting by just looking for a predetermined relationship, but actually asking the open question, what are the relationships inherent in this data?
The problem with that is, I suppose, it's harder to get funding for that sort of thing, unless you ask a question, I suppose, for research funders' purposes.
It needs discipline from a number. Research funders have got to think, well, is this going to be a productive enterprise or not? And journals have got to think about it too, because they really ought to be asking their referees, is the paper I'm looking at, does it contain essentially cherry-picked data? Or should this person be standing back and looking at the whole of the data? There's been a case recently where an analysis of something like 50 of the benchmark papers in preclinical oncology, only about 10% of the results can be replicated. And the principal reason is that the data has been inadequately described, inadequately presented, and the experiment inadequately put up. And one of the problems we have is that there may be many areas of science where the conclusions that we think of as robust are actually no more than myth, largely because of the absence of a really logical connection between the conclusions that have been drawn and the way in which the data has been used.
Thanks to Professor Geoffrey Boulton there. For more information on the Royal Society report on open science, indeed to download the full report, go to their website royalsociety.org. There are links to all the items on this week's show on our blog at guardian.co.uk/scienceweekly. That's all we have for this week. You can keep up to speed with breaking science news at any time on guardian.co.uk/science. But from me, Alok Jha, and Science Weekly producer Jason Phipps, it's goodbye.
The Guardian has partnered with audible.co.uk to offer listeners a free audiobook when you sign up for a 1-month, no-commitment trial of the Audible service. Audible has over 50,000 audiobook titles available to download. Go to guardian.co.uk/audible for further details.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.